Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining me today on the Class War Battlefield podcast. Please do me the honor of supporting this work that I am doing. I've been doing this work now for free on your behalf for, my God, 11 years. 5, 10, 20, 50. If you can afford it, please do. Cash at me at $CWB Podcast. CWB Podcast. Cash App it. CWB Podcast. Also, hit me up on PayPal, CWB Podcast, all the way across the board, y'all. Help me out. Thank you for donating, and enjoy the show.
Now, Jim, show this gentleman how you can dance and sing.
That's my attitude towards the Western powers. If you want to say there's no rules, fine. Don't go crying for your mummy when that comes.
America today finds herself in a unique situation. She's the only country in history in a position to become involved in a bloodless revolution.
If America does not respond creatively to the challenge to banish racism, some future historian will have to say that a great civilization died because it lacked the soul and commitment to make justice a reality for all men.
When a system doesn't work for the majority of the people, you gotta change the system.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. I am your brother Vimeridis Ogaya, and welcome to this Class War Battlefield podcast episode. Support the work I'm doing here. Cash App, CWB Podcast, or PayPal, CWB Podcast. So, let's imagine we lived in a world that a lot of people over the age of 50 wish we did live in. And I say that because I've literally been told this. Let's say we stopped aging at 40. We didn't age any longer. We got older, but our bodies didn't age any longer. I think most people would say, well, why 40? Why not 30? Why not 35? I get it. Let's just say 40. Does it have anything to do with the fact that I'm 40 right now? Maybe. But also, I think 40 is the age when you really see what your body's made out of. You know, you really see either how far you've fallen or how well you've done keeping your body up. 40 checks all that, you know. And in this world, Dr. Martin Luther King was alive. He was not murdered. He somehow survived. So he was always 40 until his soul gave out and wanted to go home. In this world, Dr. King is still speaking out against injustice. I would think by this point in the future, his more extreme philosophies and desires to interrupt how society worked, well, I would think they would have had a significant impact by now. But let's say he was still giving speeches. I thought about this for a while when it came to the topic I want to talk about. So he's still giving speeches, and Tyre Nichols is killed. And he's asked to speak on behalf of the Black Nation and Tyre Nichols. Or, if not on behalf of the Black Nation, just, you know, the man can move a crowd. So, let's get him speaking. After the last 10 years, and, you know, with the election of Barack Obama, and Barack Obama's disdain for doing anything for Black people, Barack Obama's absolute abandonment of the Black community, which brought him to the dance. I mean, when Joe Biden has a better Black record than you do, and you're supposedly the first Black president, I mean, that's horrible. That's not only horrible, but that is, what's that word Hillary Clinton used? Deplorable. That means that in your mind, Baracky, you are more white than you are anything else. After the disappointment of Obama, after the ascension of Trump, could you imagine Dr. King speaking to rallies during Trump's tenure as president? And then the ascension of Joe Biden, an ascension which he would probably support, looking at some of the statements he made about Ronald Reagan, and then Barry Goldwater back in the 60s. Yeah. And for those of you who don't know what I'm talking about with the Reagan thing, there's a speech that Dr. King gave in, I believe it was February of 1968. It was definitely 1968. And he slapped Reagan so hard and didn't even mention his name. Didn't even mention... He essentially spit on his home... on his whole cinema career, and then attributed his rise in popularity to the psychosis that happens when a country is obsessed with war. It's a brilliant and beautiful piece of work. I mean, oof, man. Anyway, he would have definitely supported Biden against Trump. And would have derided the alt-right, would have derided the right-wing, would have taken them to task for the fact that, you know, they are mixing Nazism with a, I don't even know what to call it, a Nordic reinterpretation of history mixed with Aryanism, mixed with imperial hubris and egotism. He would have derided them for that and would have made a lot of money doing it for the cause, because I could imagine those speeches would have been beautiful. But in thinking about how he would have dealt with the last 11 years now of deaths, we are coming up rapidly on the 10-year killing, stalking, and murdering of Trayvon Martin. It may have actually already passed, but I think we're still on the we're still coming up to it. Thinking about how he would have dealt with that, especially in light of Tyre Nichols and the policy prescriptions that his crew, his team, his advisors could have possibly suggested, especially considering the George Floyd Act is stuck in Congress, the Senate. And the Senate is beholden to right-wing ideologues on both sides, both Republicans and Democrats, I was thinking, what would he say? What would he say? And why would he say it? And while I can't be 100% sure what he would say, I do believe, given the evolution in information that has occurred in the past 40 years, I think he would reflect on the idea that we are trying to reform an institution with roots in slave catching, with roots in colonial militarism, with roots in social control from colonial militarism, with roots in the frontier ethic, with roots in understanding social hierarchies and deeming to protect those social hierarchies, and ultimately with roots in Eurocentric culture and the protection of that culture. Now, I want to leave what he would say, because I want to talk about where I'm at with this. I've done episodes on policing, only a few of them, and in one of them, I recommended a number of things that could, I believe, be done to correct the problem of policing. The fact of the matter is, policing is an institution that, if it is going to be reformed, it is going to have to be stripped down, and it'll have to be built from the bottom up because of how integrative it is into the fabric of a municipal governance structure. In fact, in order to correct policing, and by correcting, I mean strip it down, I really believe we ultimately have to look at how we view criminality and we view crime. Policing looks at crime predominantly as something that needs to be punished. Obviously, you have within the police agency, you have investigators, right? The investigators look at crime as something that needs to be solved. But most police officers, those who are on the streets doing the, you know, walking through the community, things like that, crime is something that needs to be stopped and punished. And they act like it. When I hear people talk about culture of policing, well, we don't need bad cops, they rarely ever start off by talking about what is the culture. What is the, or even more than just what is the culture, because culture comes from purpose. So what is the purpose of policing? The first thing that people usually jump to is, oh, it's to protect and serve the community. That is not the purpose of policing. That has never been the purpose of policing. The purpose of policing is to protect and serve property, property owners, and those who are highest on the social hierarchy. That is the purpose of policing. They dress it up in a myriad of other ways, but that is the purpose of policing. In fact, even policing that is supposedly communal has at its primary function is the idea of property protection. Now, I'll give you a great example of witnessing property protection in action in a way that most people don't think about. In many areas, in many communities, in many counties, in many municipalities, where there is a stark difference between the middle class and the lower classes, I know we don't talk about the lower classes in this country, but they exist. Let's say, for instance, the town of Ferguson. It is not surprising to black folks and brown folks, and I don't include many other people with that because this really does impact black and brown people the most. It doesn't surprise them that police officers often work as revenue collectors, specifically for the suburban aspects of those communities, for the middle class aspects of those communities. Now, this was actually talked about in the Justice Department's report about Ferguson, Missouri. Most people have forgotten about that. But do you realize, in their capacity as revenue collectors, because that's what the police officers are in this instance, when they are collecting revenues, they are actually protecting property. Why? Because by depriving the revenue from the poorer community and putting it into the, quote, middle-class communities, they are assuring that one side will remain poor and property less, and the other side will remain wealthy and property full. They are protecting the property of one side while eliminating it on the other side. More, if we want to take it a step over to Eurocentric culture, they are acting in the position as colonial manager. We don't often think in terms of this, and I love to see it in this aspect, because the colonial formation in this country is deep, because this country was built on colonialism. And though we don't think about it, there are instances of colonizing forces and imperial forces throughout this country, all over the place, in institution after institution, in statute after statute, things that have been around for 150 years. Well, if something's been around for 150 years or 175 years, 150 would take it at the present time, all the way back to the 1870s, when the country was settling the West. You go back 175 years, now you're in 1820-something, when the country was really starting to catch up and expand quickly. But we don't think about that. We do not understand the level of colonial and imperial interference in our daily life. Police officers don't recognize it, but it's there. When they killed that activist trying to protect the forest in Atlanta from them building a civilian military installation, a police training ground called Cop City, they were demonstrating their role as imperial enforcers. The imperial government wants this land, and those of you who do not want to get off this land are illegals. You forfeit the right to any kind of right. We will kill you if we have to make sure that this land becomes what the imperial wants it to become. Now, I know, For some of you, you're listening to this and you're going, I don't know, that just sounds a little bit old, you know, imperial government, colonial. What are you talking about? It is hard to make somebody see something when it makes them too uncomfortable to see it. Trust me when I tell you, this is not stuff that, you know, oh, I figured it out yesterday. No, this has been slowly building. I've been reading stuff, checking on stuff, and it's like, damn, you know something? Okay, maybe I'm not crazy. Maybe I do see what I see. And look, I got to be clear here. I think a lot of police officers know their role. They're not stupid about it. And they go along with it, whether they agree with it or not. Could there be good police officers? I've met some of them. Hell yes. But policing was not created to be populated with a bunch of social workers. It was created to be populated with a bunch of headhunters and head knockers. That's what it was created for. Back in the day, they were a little bit more forthright with that. They would tell you that. Today, they try to hide it. Today, they try to hide it. Now, the reason why policing has access to military-grade weapons isn't just because there's legislation, yada, yada, yada. No. Policing, even before it was called that, always had access to military weaponry. It just varied what level and what style. Because as I was wonderfully informed by a former military friend of mine who has been all over the world, worked in multiple satellite countries that the United States basically controls, everybody there in those countries understands one thing. The police officers are an offshoot of the military. In the United States, it's no different. It's no different. So, you know, because I want to get to a couple of things when it comes to solutions here. Again, at a national level, policing would have to be broken down. I mean, it would have to be broken down. Criminality would have to be completely reassessed. And I know for some folks, that's uncomfortable. You know, police, you know, just get rid of policing. I would love to. And if I thought I could snap my fingers together and make it happen tomorrow, let's do it. Let's do it. But I don't believe it's happening tomorrow. But I do believe there is a wave of accountability that's happening right now and the potential for some serious reforms are staring us in the face right now. And in some communities, policing is going to be broken down. And they're going to try new things. And those things are going to be very successful. And some of those things won't be. But I guarantee in 10 years, if this wave keeps up, keeps going, keeps moving, policing in this country is going to look drastically different. We are going to have social workers. We are going to have... Well, I guess social workers is really where we're at with a lot of that. But we're going to have de-escalation personnel. We're going to have family trauma resources that are going to be funded not only by the municipality, but by the state and by the federal government. I mean significant funding. No more of this, we're going to put $20 billion and hope that it helps. You have 350 million people. You have tens of millions of families in this country. And you're going to put $20 billion? No. To actually deal with the psychological trauma that capitalism hoists among a community, among a family, among a block, among an individual, a parent, a child, you're going to have to put a good $120, $130, $150 billion in every single year into mental health care. Instead of every year increasing the amount of money that this country is putting into military stuff, into intelligence stuff. I mean, you're talking about a total intelligence military budget allowance every year now of between $1.1 and $1.5 trillion, about half, between 40% and half of all discretionary spending. For what? For what? You're literally hollowing out the country, doing nothing. Anyway, that type of investment into mental health care at all levels is going to require the hiring of tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands. That means training, significant training of people who will be working at the communal level to solve these issues. You're talking about psychiatrists, psychologists, therapists, all the like. See, this is why. This is one of the reasons. Oh, man, I don't even know. Do I want to really go into that? Oh, could I? This is one of the reasons why the healthcare industry opposes national healthcare. Because once when you implement national healthcare, then you start looking at the structure of healthcare and what it is doing right and what it is doing wrong. And right now, there is a severe shortage of psychologists, psychiatrists, and therapists throughout the country. And big insurance loves it that way because then they can keep the prices high. If you start to train 400, 500, 600, 1,000, maybe 800,000, maybe a million new people that fit those three categories and distribute them across the country with great pay, the price of their services plummets. Plummets. There's all throughout this country, and I'll jump back into the other thing in a minute, all throughout this country, medical personnel is at a premium. I was looking at numbers in 2018 in the United States had it was in trouble. And everybody saw it. The U.S. was in a deficit on all of its major medical employment statistics. It's worse now. Nationally, the U.S. federal government is going to have to do something about this sooner or later. The question is, how long will they wait to do it? Back to the policing, back to, you know, what could replace policing. Being able to have family therapists and psychologists and psychiatrists would be a huge gain for communities. Would be a huge gain for communities. Having rehabilitation programs, real rehabilitation programs, not these, look, there's some good ones throughout the country, so pardon me, guys, I'm not really talking about you. But you have a lot of flimsy ones. You know, when somebody gets out of supposedly what's called a correctional facility, a jail, the United States doesn't give them the proper resources necessary to reintegrate them into civil society. You're going to have to put money behind that. And then you're going to have to deal with the necessities in life. I've said it before and I'll say it again. I'll probably keep saying it. Roosevelt's Second Bill of Rights isn't dead. And if you don't know what Roosevelt's Second Bill of Rights is, go out there and see. There is so much that needs to be done, you know? And when it comes to policing, policing can be restructured to be a positive force. I mean, you know, community patrol is something that, yeah, okay, fine, I get that, I understand that. You want to do a community patrol? Fine, let's do it. But do you have to look like a soldier going to war when you patrol in the community? No. It's time to start putting limitations on the amount of weapons that they're having, which I think is something that's going to come up. So, beyond that, and I think, you know, there's other people talking about changes that need to occur. I'm just a guy giving my opinion. But beyond that, we are going to have to ask some tough questions about the society that has been built on the principles of capitalism and what that society must look like in the long run. This does not have anything to do with policing, but I have to mention here the water problems in the West. That is just so devastatingly frightening to me. The evaporation rate of some of the largest rivers out west. The potential deactivation due to water level of huge dams out west is just staggering to me. And the people who are going to be most impacted by it, and I forgot to mention the Salt Lake in Utah, man. The people who are going to be most impacted by it are the ones who are bringing in the politicians who are exasperating it. By the way, to all the Mormon family, peace and love to y'all. I grew up in Wayne County, New York. Y'all know where that is, because that is where y'all's Mecca is, as it was. I know some of you don't like that phrase, but, you know, it's a y'all flock there. What many of y'all, I think, don't know, and God bless you for it, is y'all owe a lot of y'all religion, or at least in the beginning, a lot of y'all religion, to Native Indigenous people. Y'all know that, right? They helped y'all out a lot. And, yeah, I guess that's all I'm going to say on that. But they did. And y'all repaid them by screwing up their holy land. And by holy land, I really do mean one of my brothers. Ain't really my brother, you know. But he's my brother. He's a Native boy. And he told me of a sacredness, a sacred spot out there in what is called Salt Lake, the Salt Lake out there in Utah. And they used to perform rituals out there. They used to do their powwow, which the Mormons use now, out there. It was not just a spot for one tribe either. They literally brought tribes out there from all over what we would call this continent. And they would do rituals and things out there. And one of the problems, he thought, was that because the rituals weren't being done anymore, that it was having a negative impact on the planet. Now, understand something. The Native Indigenous people here did things for specific reasons. And most of y'all don't know about those reasons. They have spots and locations where upon doing whatever they did, they get access to other dimensions. And I know that's crazy to be talking about on a show called Class War Battlefield Podcast, but I'm telling the truth. And they also get access to Mother Earth, and they could communicate with her and tell her things that she needs to know, and she could tell them things that they need to know. Like, next winter's going to be horrible. You might want to really, like, put extra meat away. Or, in two winters, ooh, get ready. It's going to be a heat wave. You're only going to get, like, 350 inches of snow instead of 590. By the way, for those of you who think that those numbers are insane, back in those days, there were areas in this country where that was considered, like today, or even 20, 30 years ago, there are areas in this country that would get like 150, 200 inches of snow and be like, oh my God, it's so much. But back in the 1700s and the 1800s, those places would get two times that. And that would be considered a moderate to ordinary winter. So, they would do that. And unfortunately, they are not able to do that kind of stuff anymore. They're not. And part of the problem that we are facing is because they can't do their work anymore. Y'all may not see the importance to what I just said, but trust me when I tell you, it's important. It's very important. I'm going to call this one. It's a little bit early, earlier than normal. If you have any questions, comments, concerns, you can always reach out to me. As I said at the beginning, I'll say it again. If you like the content, please support me. 5, 10, 20, 50, whatever you can do. CWB Podcast for Cash App, CWB Podcast. Money sign that one, don't forget. And then CWB Podcast for PayPal. I am your brother, Vimer Dees. See you on the next one. Peace. There's a shadow on the faces of the men who sent the guns to the wars that are fought in places where their business interest runs. On the radio, talk shows, and the TV, you hear one thing again and again. How the USA stands for freedom, and we come to the aid of a friend. But who are the ones that we call our friends? These governments killing their own, or the people who finally can't take anymore, and they pick up a gun or a brick or a stone.